Hello and welcome to another podcast. This is the Home is Where the Hearth Is podcast, where we talk about this, that, or the other, depending upon how the muse takes us. But at the moment, we're working through methodically the texts I've been teaching in the imaginative literature course I'm teaching from Memorial College, a master's level course. And for each of the texts, I prepared 15 discussion questions, which form the basis of the collaborative discussion after each class session. And so I've been going through those, and we're actually now, we've done the Iliad and the Odyssey, we're now actually on the Aeneid by Virgil, so moving from Greece to Rome. And we had our first session on the Aeneid last week, so we're now reconvene. We covered 6 questions last week of the 15, so we're going to reconvene with question 7, which is: at their first meeting, Dido empathizes and sympathizes with the plight of Aeneas and his people on the grounds of having experienced hardship and forced wandering like your own, as she says. It is through pain that she has, quote, learned to comfort suffering men. How should such words be received by the reader? How does this impact our understanding of Dido's character and her relationship with Aeneas? Okay, interesting. So, you know, Dido, in the backstory, has had her own suffering. She's lost her husband. So as a widow, she's endeavouring to build the city of Carthage. And that's what she's doing, and what she's in the midst of doing, coping with her grief and being a responsible queen, when Aeneas arrives on the scene. And rather than turning him away, she offers him welcome on the basis that that they have a lot in common, that they have both been faced hardship and forced wandering, and that she empathizes and sympathizes with Aeneas's pain because she has suffered herself. So what does this do for us? Well, I think it sets up Dido initially as a sympathetic figure, one who empathizes and understands and suffered herself. What makes this complicated is, of course, is that the passionate affair between them, which is an act of irresponsibility on both their parts, in the sense that they're both neglecting their duties, this invests us in the relationship. It invests us in Dido's character and personality, which allows us to feel the pathos of the situation when that relationship goes awry. So if you like, it deepens our engagement with the human dimension of the epic, I would suggest. Question 8. What role do Venus and Amor play in the relationship between Dido and Aeneas? What might this say about Virgil's understanding of erotic love? So again, we see this in Homer as well, but I don't think quite as bluntly or lacking in subtlety, where the gods meddle and interfere in the affairs of men, not least in causing them to, should we say, in inverted commas, fall in love. Now, we know from Christian writers like Shakespeare that this is not something that's peculiar to the pagans. Romeo and Juliet, of course, allow themselves to fall into a reckless abandonment to self and to reason and to responsibilities to other, to moral rectitude, because they allow themselves to fall in love in this manner. In fact, the imagery that's used by Romeo at the beginning of the play is that madness, as a Roma, that a love is a form of madness. So, you know, it seems that we are overpowered by something which is beyond our control, which is why one can imagine that people can see a supernatural component to this, something which is more powerful than we are coming into play. So when Dido and Aeneas fall so passionately in love to such a degree that it has negative consequences with respect to their own moral rectitude and responsibility, it's easy to blame the gods, or even to give the gods credit, because of course Venus does this somewhat cynically so that Aeneas might benefit from this relationship. Not sure exactly how that what she thinks about it as it plays itself out, because in the end that Aeneas clearly neglecting the will of Jove, of Zeus. Venus is herself overpowered, if you like, by a greater god. So I think my concern, I suppose, if that's the right word, from a Christian perspective, is that that Virgil is far too flippant, if you like, in the way in which Venus can bestow her venereal graces, if that's the right word, on mortals. Although, of course, the morality that plays itself out in the relationship between Dido and Aeneas does suggest that Virgil was very much aware that however passionate a love affair might be, it's still subject to reason and responsibility. Question 9. How does Aeneas present the character of the Greeks in general and Ulysses in particular? What are we to make of this revisionist or subversive approach by Virgil to Homer's original epic? Well, of course, the whole thing about the Aeneid is it inverts, I won't say perverts, because it depends upon your perspective, but it certainly inverts the our understanding of the struggle that we get from Homer. Now, Homer is certainly sympathetic for Troy. Homer, in fact, is much more sympathetic and empathetic towards Troy than Virgil is towards the Greeks. I think that's fairly indicative of Homer being the better, in the sense of more subtle and nuanced writer who can actually empathize with both sides and not merely dramatize in two dimensions. But certainly, Aeneas' presentation of the Greeks in general, and Ulysses in particular, Ulysses, of course, Odysseus, who's becomes the villain of the whole epic in Virgil's handling of it through the words of Aeneas, is to turn things inside out from an Homeric perspective. Of course, you know, this is because Virgil's a Roman, and the Romans have been at war with the Greeks, and the irony is, of course, that the culturally he has been conquered by them, because he's basically, without Homer and the Greek gods and the Greek epics, Virgil would have nothing to say, nor would Aeneas, who indeed is plucked from Homer's Iliad in the first place. Question 10. In Aeneas's account of the fall of Troy, he highlights both human and divine deception. How does this impact our understanding of what might be called the moral and theological underpinnings of Aeneas's Virgilian spin on Homer's epic? What Virgil does, not with great subtlety, it's really, we can see it almost as propagandistic. This is propaganda on the part of Rome against her enemies. In that sense, we see that the Greeks are depicted as being deceptive, liars, cheats, who couldn't possibly win fairly. They had to win through deception, the Trojan horse, etc. And indeed, that the gods of the Greeks act as despicably. So I think what it highlights is that Virgil is using Homer as a springboard to turn inside out by the purposes of Roman propaganda and Roman patriotism. Question 11. Compare and contrast Homer's and Virgil's depiction of the character of Priam. How does each handle the pathos of Priam's predicament? And Priam, of course, king of Troy, father of Hector, etc., father of Paris. Now, Homer deals with it again. With both of them, treat Priam's final moments. We don't actually see Priam's death in the Iliad, but it's clearly on the way. But treat it with a great deal of pathos, a great deal of pity. But I think that Homer also gives Priam a great deal of dignitas. Okay, he has dignitas and gravitas a dignity and a gravity of person in his character. The fact that he freely chooses as a king to empty himself and to beg for the body of his son from Achilles. In this we really do feel for him. Whereas in the Aeneid, Priam is just a pathetic, weak old man who, you know, takes up his arms, but is clearly completely impotent physically against the power of the young warriors. So yeah, and certainly Virgil depicts his death and the death of his family in a way which will. Cause us to sympathize greatly, maybe even bring tears to our eyes. But there's a lack of subtlety. Priam is merely a victim of circumstance and a victim of old age, and is seen as being completely and utterly impotent. There's a more solidity to the fullness of his character in the three choices he makes in Homer's Iliad. Question 12. Why does Venus save Helen from Aeneas' vengeance? What might this say about Virgil's approach to venereal or erotic passion? Does this differ from Homer? Well, answering the last question first, I would say yes and no. Certainly, you know, Homer, like Virgil, has the gods indulging their favourites. And of course, Venus is on the side of Helen. And Paris in both Homer's epic and in Virgil's. So in that sense, it's the same. But I do think that the way that Venus sort of almost makes an apology, not in the sense of mea culpa, mea maxima culpa, but an apology as in an apologist, makes a defense of Helen's actions. In order to preserve and save her, and just distracts Aeneas and says Aeneas has other and more important things to worry about. So, but largely not much of a difference, I would say there. I think we're going to try to get through the final three today. So maybe I'll speed up a bit so we move on to another text next week. Question 13. Virgil speaks of Aeneas and Dido as being prisoners of lust who are each unmindful of the realm. Does their lust differ from the love which Venus represents? If so, how do they differ? If not, how does their synonymous juxtaposition impact our understanding of the epic? Okay, so Virgil doesn't really distinguish between the sort of so-called love that Venus bestows and the lust that he condemns. And yet he doesn't seem to be condemning it when Venus bestows it. So it's this is... perhaps a problem that erotic passion seems to be something which is okay unless it impacts what we're meant to be doing in terms of our responsibility. I don't see any major distinction in between lust and love in the way that Virgil depicts it in the epic. It's just that the lustful love, the erotic love, the erotic passion is okay until it causes us to neglect more important things. I could be wrong about that. It could well be that Virgil is showing us that erotic passion is ultimately dangerous and damaging. But to me, it's not clear from the text. Question 14. What does Virgil's employment of the metaphors of the wind and the oak tree in Book 4 tell us about his understanding of the relationship between rational will and passionate desire? Well, this explains why I'm not completely sure, because for me this metaphor is very clear, that the passions are like winds, like gale force winds that blow us and buffet us and cause us to sway. But insofar as we are rooted in virtue and the rational will, we are like an oak tree. That it doesn't matter how much we are buffeted by passion, by irrational lust, any other passions, envy, greed, any of the seven deadly sins, insofar as we're rooted in an understanding and a practice of reason and virtue, we will be able to withstand whatever tempestuous passions affront us. All right, and finally, question 15. Considering that the Aeneid is an unfinished work, and considering the moral trajectory of the epic at the point of its premature conclusion, how might we conjecture that it might have finished? Okay, so we're going to finish largely with a moot point, if you like, something which we can't, a hypothetical question, because we don't know. That's the Aeneid is an unfinished work. Virgil died before completing it. If he's trying to emulate Homer, he's only halfway through it, because Homer's epics both have 24 books. This has 12 books when it cuts off short. So it's very difficult to know where the trajectory is leading, but it's quite clear that at some point Rome is going to arise, if you like, from the ashes of Troy, that Aeneid will be the founder of Rome. And then to the extent to which the story of Rome will be told beyond that, it's impossible for us to know. But certainly the whole epic is moving towards that, its point and its purpose, which is a patriotic, almost propagandistic work of nationalism on the part of Virgil to eulogize the founding myth of the founding father, if you like, of the Roman nation. Okay, and on that note, we'll finish for today, and we'll begin with another text. I think it will probably be I think next on the list is the Divine Comedy, and we'll probably go to hell next next week. Not literally, just literarily. Thanks be to God. Okay, thanks so much for joining me in this Home and Where the Hearth Is podcast in the Inner Sanctum. Please do join me next week and check out the other podcasts on the site. God bless. Bye-bye.